Where will she go? Again, the ground shudders. She staggers, dropping to one knee, then struggling to stand anew. The shuttle. It's safe there, at least from the storm. She takes him inside the darkened Imperial ship. She summons as much saliva to her mouth as she can muster, which is very little, and she cleans his cheeks. Then she tries to start the ship. No go. It's dead. The engines have failed, and the fuel cells have died trying to give life to this ruined machine. She is stranded. She sits in the pilot's seat. She eases Brenton into the seat next to her. Nora holds his cold, stiff hand. For a time, she sleeps. The sound of a ship's engine wakes her. She looks out the cockpit viewport and sees through the dust storm a gleaming, shining vessel rise up through the crimson clouds. The yacht moves swiftly and is gone. A hallucination, she thinks. Some dread phantasm to tease her.
Look at the pretty, shiny ship. Don't you wish you could be on it?
Sleep takes her again. Sleep like death, dark and dreamless. The same sound, a replay of the last, draws her once more out of the deep. Ship engines humming. She peers out and sees nothing. But the scuff of a heel behind her has her lurch to her feet. Sloane! Nora! It's not Sloane. It's Jazz. Jazz flanked by a tall Cayuso alien in a broad domed hat.
Jazz Amari, her savior.
Jazz Amari, her ride home. Chapter 38. An empire does not end all at once. And this one, the Galactic Empire that began when Palpatine stole the Old Republic, is no different. For this empire, it is death by a thousand cuts. A slow bleed that began perhaps not when the first Death Star was destroyed, but very early, when it killed the Jedi to make way for its regime. When a pair of twins, one named Luke, the other named Leia, fell through the cracks, lost to their father and to his dark master, both of whom were blinded by hate and ego. Other injuries only hastened its demise. The birth of the rebellion, the death of their first superweapon, the distrust that widened the gap between Vader and the Emperor, and of course, the Empire's colossal loss at Endor. Now an even greater loss at Jakku was the final wound. History would remember that the New Republic was victorious on this day, and that is true. History will forget, however, how in reality this final wound was a self-inflicted one. A contingency plan by a callous, vengeful emperor who never wanted his empire in the hands of a successor. Even still, though the Empire's death comprises a thousand cuts, only one thing makes it official. The signing of a ceasefire. One that accords both the end of combat and the full, unconditional surrender of the Galactic Empire. Mos Amida comes out of hiding, rescued, in his account, by a gaggle of Coruscanti children who had helped form the backbone of their own resistance movement. He had been held captive by his own people, on order from the usurper Gallius Rax. Now free, and with Imperial forces destroyed, he was free to sign a meaningful Imperial instrument of surrender. Mon Mothma demands that this take place on Chandrilla, the same place that the Empire attacked on Liberation Day. The signing occurs on the Crystal Cliffs, north of Hana City, under an ancient tint olive tree. The Chancellor is flanked by her two advisors, Syngir Rathvelis and Hosnian Prime's Sondeev Sela. Princess Leia is present as well. The signing occurs during the third hour of her labor, though she only tells her husband this after the ceremony is complete, at which point he hurries her off to the birthing chamber in the heart of Hana City. The Empire is surrendered with minimal concession. The instrument of surrender, informing the Galactic Concordance, demands not only that all fighting cease on behalf of the Empire, but also that the Imperial government dissolve immediately. After which Mon Mothma signs a further declaration, denoting that all still living Imperial officials are now categorized as war criminals. Non-combatant functionaries within the Imperial government are given conditional pardons, provided they continue to act by the Articles of the Galactic Concordance. Mos Amida, in return, escapes without such formal censure, though certainly the stigma never leaves him. The media and the history books both brand him as a toady and a lackey, and one of the willing, if weak, architects of the Empire. Even still, he is granted a provisional and powerless government on Coruscant, left with New Republic overseers who help confirm that he remains as little more than a figurehead, continuing his toothless rule over a troubled world. After the ceremony is complete, Mon Mothma thanks Sinjir with a bottle of something very expensive, a lacrimide from before the birth of the Empire. Inside the bottle, the liquid, which, if we're being honest, is really just the fermented tears of the sentient bees of the Nem Hive, has a golden glow, like sunlight on the sea. When you shake it, the glow strengthens.
Hope through agitation,
Mon Mothma explains.
The light glows stronger when we struggle.
From before the Empire, you say?
He asks.
From a better day, yes.
He thanks her. She asks him if he'll drink it.
No, he says, to his own surprise. Not today, at least.
This feels somehow too special to violate with my crass tongue.
You've matured,
she tells him.
Just like this wine, he says with a wink.
The war ends. The Empire dies. But the battle goes on. Though the ceasefire is signed, the Battle of Jakku still rages. Its forces there refuse to surrender. They fight past the point of sanity. For weeks, then months. The shattered Imperial remnant has no strategy. Their base is overtaken. The captains of the lingering Imperial fleet use more dramatic and desperate tactics as the battle rages. Many trying to mimic the tractor beam snare that served as Augate's final maneuver in this life. A few of those captains, utilizing mysterious coordinates, jump into unknown space. It is assumed that their disappearance is tantamount to suicide. This remnant is like a parasite with its head sunk in the meat of its own certainty, teeth biting tight. It takes months for the fighting to truly end. Months for the New Republic soldiers to round up the captives and count the dead. All that time for the Empire's ghost to catch up with the death of its body and realize that the fight is well and truly over. Even then, it doesn't stop across the galaxy. Remnants remain. Some hide out, waiting for some savior to come save them. Others go out with spectacular flare-ups of violence and viciousness. But these remnants are few. Gallius Rax did the work of destroying the domain properly. Those that linger cannot stay long. The rest are prisoners. So many that the New Republic has no idea what to do with them. On Jakku, the war leaves behind a world of wreckage. Scavengers feast upon the remains. Nima the Hutt emerges even before the fighting is truly over, to begin hoarding what she and her people can find. Already a black market forms around the junk and debris. Weapons and computers and engines, all littering the sand like the markets of a massive graveyard. Nima sits at the center of this black market, like a fat, throbbing tumor diverting blood flow to itself. The galaxy heals. The people do too. But a grievous injury such as the one caused by the Empire cannot heal without leaving scars behind as a reminder. Akiva. The jungle is thick, though the air is thicker. The funeral traditions of the world are many, But this is the one that Nora and her family cleave to. Brenton Wexley's body is wrapped in a gauzy cloth. Friends and family heap him with garlands of haika flowers, which are as orange and as soft as the tail feathers of a firebird. Then they sing songs and tell stories over him before sinking him in the salt marsh. The salt will eat the body over a short time, and it will claim him. He may return to Akiva as a child of Akiva. From water they arise, to water they return, atoms to atoms. But before the body sinks down, Temin rushes up to his father and places across him a different honorific. A metal arm. A droid arm. It belonged to Bones, and is the only part of his mechanical friend he was able to rescue from the sands of Jakku. Temin, trying desperately not to cry, whispers,
"Bones, you watch over my dad, okay? Keep him safe."
Then he hugs both of them together. The salt mire takes the body. Nora falls to the ground crying, and Temin holds her for a time as his aunts stand by. When all the others have gone, he helps her stand. They spend a few days with the ants, and then it's time to go home.
Thanks to a friend who is now apparently a high-ranking advisor to the Chancellor of the New Republic, Jaz Amari not only gets Dengar, Embo, and Jeeta full pardons, she actually manages to get them some money from the New Republic. Not as much as she promised, no, but it's enough to stop them from killing her, and enough to convince them to remain formed up as a new crew. Dengar seems particularly pleased by this turn of events.
"Times they are a-changing, my little compass. We're gonna need to watch each other's backs, eh?"
Even still, she takes some time on Chandrila to herself. She tells her new crew she'll track them down when the time is right. For now, she says, she has to find somebody else. The story made its way to her that John Burrell went to Jakku to save her. Laughable, really. Because what? He's going to save her? Oh, so she can't take care of herself. Jaz feels she's proven very well that she has. And so her plan is to go to his apartment, look him dead in the eye, the one eye, since the other is gone, give him a stern lecture on her ability to save herself, thank you very much, and then kiss him until he can't breathe. But when she gets there, he's not at home. Someone else is there. A woman. A commando by the uniform. Jaz feels embarrassed, and she stammers an apology. The woman just says she's here to collect Jom's things.
"Why? Where is he gone?" "Gone to where we all go," the woman says.
Jaz still doesn't understand, so the woman spells it out plainly.
"He died on Jakku."
It takes too long for Jaz to understand. Even when it hits her, it still doesn't hit her. The woman says there's a video from the U-Wing, and she asks if Jaz wants to see it. She doesn't, but she says yes anyway. So she watches it. It's short and choppy, standard for a combat cam. The ship drops into atmosphere, and the Spec Force commandos are hanging near the exit, ready to jump out and join the war even before the damn thing has a chance to land. Jaz sees Jom there, and he leans in toward the cam and gives it a wink and a hard nod.
"New Republic, Auga!"
And the rest of the commandos, men and women, echo that word.
"Auga!"
Some battle cry Jaz doesn't understand. Jom smirks one last time. From outside the door, from the surface of Jakku, Jaz sees the glint of something. A missile, maybe? Concussive, probably. None of the others see it. None except Jom. He bellows,
"Incoming!"
And then he does the unthinkable. Jom puts his foot down on the lip of the open door,
leaping right past the beam cannon placement and out into open air. He stays aloft, pulsing his jetpack. Two hard burns of blue energy out the back, and he heads right toward the missile. The U-Wing pivots to port side, lifting up and away from the incoming projectile. As it moves, Jom disappears out of frame, and Jazz feels her innards tightening as she inwardly screams that she wants the camera to shift back down again. Down, down, so she can see him one last time. Everything goes white and pixelated.
I don't understand,
Jazz says when the vid is over.
He should have mounted that cannon.
Would have taken a few seconds to spin up. By then, too late.
He didn't need to do that.
He did, and he saved us.
That's all Dacen needs to say. Jazz thanks the woman and leaves. It takes days for her to process it. Days of walking around like she's in someone else's body. Days until the truth of the thing hits her with the impact of a wall falling upon her.
He came to save me, and he died in service to that. He followed his heart, and it got him killed.
And then she's left to wonder, would she make the same choice? Does she have a larger purpose, a greater debt? And is she willing to pay it? Maybe she's the one without a star. She spends the next week in bed, staring at the ceiling. War is about loss, yes. But when it ends, joy surges. How could it not? Burying the dead is a somber act. But the celebration that follows confirms that they did not die in vain. They died to make the galaxy free. And my, does the galaxy celebrate? Not only has the Empire's gauntleted fist let go of the galaxy's neck, it is gone entirely. The oppression is at an end. And so the celebrations go for weeks. Fireworks on Chandrilla. Festivals of food on Nakadiya. Non-stop parties in the streets and on the rooftops of Coruscant. And this time, the Empire isn't there to stop it. They do not police these carnivals and festivities. No troopers show up to fire upon the parades or execute protesters. It's just one more sign that the Empire is well and truly gone. The New Republic demonstrates that it is the polar opposite of the Galactic Empire. It encourages the celebrations. It holds official revels and pageants and exaltations of joy. Wherever the New Republic's light touches, it marks the occasion with a holiday. Liberation Day is remade into the 7-day Festival of Liberation. And then, there is the matter of a child. On the day the instruments of surrender are signed, a child is born on Chandrilla to Leia Organa and Han Solo. Friends and family gather. Rumors fly about who was there and who was not. Some say that the golden boy, Luke Skywalker, made an appearance and then was gone again, off on some untold mission. Others say his absence was conspicuous. Missing, too, was Solo's co-pilot, who is said to have finally found his own Wookiee family on Kashyyyk. Stories of the birth range from the dramatic and fortuitous to the utterly inauspicious. One story suggests that the birthing chamber was occupied for 3 whole days while Leia struggled. Another tells the tale that it was fast and painless. She merely needed to calm herself and meditate to make the moment as untroubled as a mountain lake. Some say the boy was born with a shock of black hair. Others that he had a full set of teeth. Others still that he was just a baby, like any other. Sweet one moment, screaming the next, and nestling in his mother as any healthy child does. What is known is this. The child's name is Ben. And he takes his father's last name, even as Leia keeps only her own family name, Organa. Han looks into the eyes of his son.
My son. How the hell did that happen?
Well,
he knows how that happened.
A night under the stars and the canopy of Endor trees. But in the larger sense, the galaxy is a far stranger place than he figured on if it's letting him be a father. Solo stands in the nursery alone. The boy, Ben, wriggles and gurgles in the round white bubble of protection that is the infancy cradle. Han leans forward over it, arms crossed on the rail while looking down at the child's chubby face and dark eyes. They regard each other. The child burbles. While Leia is in the other room taking a shower, Han says in a low voice,
"Hey, it's you and me, kid. Old damn galaxy against us, but we'll make it through okay. I'm not always going to be the best dad. Come on. I don't know what the hell I'm doing here. I can barely take care of myself, but I'll always keep us pointed in the right direction. Even if we zig and zag a little to get there."
There's your first lesson.
Sometimes doing the right thing doesn't mean following a straight line. Sometimes you gotta...
He takes his hand and gestures with it, like it's a fish swimming this way and that, left and right and up and down.
"Don't tell your mother I said that."
Ben starts to cry. It comes on fast, like a tropical downpour. He's staring up, all innocent, and then it hits him. Boom! The little body tightens up, and his mitts make little rubbery fists and punch the air. His white cheeks bloom with red. The sound coming out of him is like a storm siren.
Han winces. Oh, hell. He looks around him like there's gotta be something or someone there to save him.
Nearby, he finds a small Tuca doll that Lando sent over, and he takes it and thrusts it into the air above the boy and wiggles it.
"Here, look, the cat is dancing? Dancing, Tuca? Come on, kid, you gotta give me something here."
It does nothing to stem the tide of tears. Han growls, looking around for something else. He's about to yell for Leia, but there she is, coming in through the doorway.
"He's, he's making that sound again."
"He's crying."
"Right, yeah."
Han holds up a finger.
"It's not my fault."
"Han," Leia says, coming over to him, still in her towel. "It's okay. He's a baby. Babies cry. It's how they tell you they want something."
"Oh, yeah, no, of course. Maybe you could do your,
He mimes his hand, floating in the air in an almost religious gesture. Leia has a connection with the kid that he can never have. Like Luke, she has the Force. That's a thing he never used to believe in. But since getting caught up with this group, he's seen a whole lot of strangeness just to believe it's just a bunch of hooey. Leia can't do what Luke can do, and maybe never will. But she can quiet the kid with but the faintest of gestures. He hates to admit it, but he's jealous of that. Han will never have that with Ben. They're connected in a way he can't even begin to understand.
"You know, use the Force."
"Why don't we try something else?"
"A little brandy on his gums?"
"Pick him up," she says.
"Just pick him up."
"Yes, he's your son. Use your hands. Go on, Han, pick him up. He wants to be snuggled."
"I smuggle, not snuggle."
"Han." He sighs.
"Okay, okay."
He stoops down and gingerly reaches for his son. He hoists him up, and Ben twists and turns in his grip.
"He's so small."
Han thinks how easy it would be to break him, or to drop him. The boy is vulnerable to everything. And so he does what feels most natural. He protects the kid by bringing him close to his chest. And just like that, Ben stops crying. The boy nuzzles up against his collarbone. He burps once, his dark eyes pinched shut, and he's out like a light.
See?
She says.
You don't need the force at all.
But I'll never have what you have with him.
You don't have to,
she says sweetly.
You will have your own thing, because you're his father.
Weeks later, Nora's old crew gathers again. Not for an assignment. They gather because it may be the last time they see one another for a while. Maybe forever, given the way things sometimes go. The tavern they find themselves in is one of Sinjir's favorites. Up on the side of a cliff overlooking the Silver Sea, they gather to drink, and they drink to John and to Oxy and to Brenton Wexley. And of course, they drink to Mr. Bones and tell stories about that mad, dancing murder droid until they're all laughing so hard they're crying. They drink to the Empire and to the New Republic. They drink to Leia and Han and the new baby, who surely is keeping them up at nights. Squalling grub monkey, Sinjir calls the boy. When they talk of the child, Sinjir adds, as if surprised, Did you know the child did not smell bad? Not at all? Condor laughs and explains, Sin thought the baby would stink. Of course I did. Babies are foul little gobbos covered in their own infant slime. I expected them to smell sour or diapery.
Oh, Sinjir, no,
Nora says, her cheeks blushing with a bit of inebriation from the junipera she's been drinking.
No, no, no. Babies smell wonderful. They smell sweet and fresh and innocent.
Sounds like you want to eat them, Sinjir says.
Wait, maybe we should eat them,
like wriggling little loaves of bread they are.
Condor drives an elbow under his ribs. He oofs. Nora continues.
Stop it. There's nothing like the smell of a new baby. That little star child smelled like he was made of clean towels.
This one here used to smell so good.
She leans into her son, who of course drinks a sensible Jogan juice. Temin wrinkles his nose in embarrassment and fails to pull away from his mother as she pinches his cheeks and makes a sound like
whooshy gooshy woo. Mom! Oh, relax, Tem. I'm your mother. I'm allowed to embarrass you from time to time. It is my parental right, sacred and omniversal.
Ugh!
Jazz leans back with a scoundrel's ease and clucks her tongue.
I think we're supposed to call him Snap now. Isn't that right?
Again, he's embarrassed, blushing as he does.
That's what the other pilots in Phantom Squadron call me. It's because I can turn like this.
He snaps his fingers.
Pow!
Everyone knows it's because of his nervous habit, one shared by his father once. But no one corrects him on it today.
Phantom Squadron? More like Fancy Squadron, Sinjir says. Even fancier is this faint dusting of...
What is that on your lip and cheek there? Dirt? Choco powder?
He leans forward with a finger to poke at it.
Ow! Hey!
Tem says.
I'm growing a beard is all.
Like John,
Jazz says.
Like John,
the rest of them echo. Again they raise their glasses, and again they clink and they drink. Condor leans forward and says to Temin,
A mouse droid tells me that the New Republic is setting up a new flight academy on Osnian Prime. And I hear you'll be a pupil there. Is that right?
Yeah, it's no big.
Perhaps you'll actually learn how to fly a ship,
Sinjir says with a wink.
You know, they're not toys you smash in the ground.
Condor tists him and says,
Don't let him sass you.
Sinjir makes a face.
I am a sassy bastard. It is my nature.
Seriously, you should be proud, Temin,
Condor says.
I bet you'll miss your mom, though, huh?
About that,
Temin says.
I'm going with him,
Nora says. Eyebrows arch in curiosity. And she answers their unspoken questions with,
Oh, relax. It's not like that. I'm not the dutiful mother unable to let go of her star pupil son. Wedge will be the head instructor there, at least to get the school set up. And he's invited me to teach, too.
She doesn't say anything about how she and Wedge have been spending considerable time together. It's not romantic. That's what she keeps telling herself, anyway. The memory of Brenton is still fresh like a burn. It's too soon to let that fade. She wants to hold on to that pain as long as she can.
Apparently, they think I'm not too terrible a pilot.
More congratulations go around. They talk for a while about what they'll all be doing. The rise of Black Sun and the Red Key leaves Jazz looking to pay her way out of her debts, something her new ragtag crew of bounty hunters can help her accomplish. Sinjir will continue advising the Chancellor, and now the race is on to find a third advisor to help balance out the constantly bickering pair of Sinjir and Sandeep Sela. Though Han and Leia aren't here, the two of them will apparently remain. Even though Sinjir notes the princess is quite keen to get back to helping those worlds still in thrall to Imperial remnants. The night goes on, and the moon brightens the silver sea. The conversation winds down, and as it happens, they peel away one by one. Jazz says she's off with the new crew. Sinjir makes a vomit face as he notes that he'll be subject to yet another early morning meeting, which, according to him, is an act of torture so vile, I should have been using it as a weapon in my arsenal all along. Outside the bar, Sinjir sends Condor on as he and Jazz hang back. A cool wind comes off the sea. Below them, waves roar against the cliffs. Jazz watches Sinjir. There's something just a little different about him now. His shoulders aren't so tight. His angles have softened, if only a little. It looks as if something has left him. A pressure, a burden, some presence she cannot fully know. It has given him an ease of posture, as if he's found some kind of peace, however strange and temporary it may be.
Looks like you found your star,
Jazz says.
Condor?
Not him. Well, maybe him. I just mean you found a life, a purpose. You've been drifting since Endor. You are a Takaskwalask Didan no more, Sinjir.
He leans in and puts an arm around her.
Oh, now, I don't know about that. Without you, I think I'll feel quite lost indeed.
You'll be fine. You've gone respectable, remember?
Respectable? Bah! I took several steps down on the moral hierarchy, going from imperial torturer to political advisor.
I'm just happy you had purpose.
Seems we all found our purpose.
She smirks, cocking her head in such a way that her singular ridge of hair flips over, revealing the side of her scalp where the horn spurs were broken off.
I never lost mine.
But it changed a little, didn't it?
It did. I learned to play well with others for one.
She sighs.
And I learned that perhaps my aunt didn't have it all wrong. Maybe I should take more, ethical jobs from now on. Nothing wrong with helping people from time to time. As long as there's a bag of credits to go along with it. One must get paid, after all.
You going to be okay?
Jazz frowns.
What? Because of my debts? I'll be fine. They've chased me for this long, and now I have this crew watching my back.
She stiffens.
Admittedly, a crew who will probably sell me out as soon as they receive a viable offer to do so, but I will burn that bridge when I get to it.
No, I mean because of Jom.
Jom. That name sucker punches her. They've been saying it all night, and it gut-kicks her every time.
Jom and I were never ever going to have a real thing. But we had something foolish and incomplete going on, and I was good with that. He was...
She tries not to break. She holds it together, if barely.
He was an idiot. Who liked me more than I liked him. And that got him killed.
That's not your fault.
No, it's not. It's his. But I still feel bad about it. And I feel worse because there's nothing I can do to balance those scales. That is a debt I can never pay back. Because there is no one to pay it to.
Life isn't all about debts.
Life is only about debts. You accumulate them, you pay them out. Others gather debts to you, and you try to collect in return.
Your whole life is a ledger?
More or less.
He hugs her close. Your cynicism gives me life, dear Chaz.
The feeling is reciprocal. Regrettably, I have to go.
We'll see each other again, won't we?
I don't know.
She answers, and it's an honest answer.
Fair enough.
He kisses her temple. She holds him for a little while longer, lingering on the cliff as the sea rolls in, bashing against the rocks. And then she goes her way, and he goes his.
We'll see them again, Temin says.
I know.
I miss Dad. I miss Bones. They should have been here.
I know. I miss them too.
She looks to her son. Even now, it's strange to see how he's grown up in this short time since she returned to Akiva. His cheeks are rounder, hair bushier. His eyes are a bit darker now too. Temin's filled out in his shoulders. When he was a baby, she marveled as he transformed into a toddling thing, and later was floored by the swift transition to the boy he became. Then boy to teenager, and now teenager to a proper young man. So many changes. It saddens her at the same time it thrills her.
We're gonna be okay,
he says, patting her hand as if sensing her distress. He has a good head on him. Maybe it took a little while to screw it on, no thanks to her. Leaving him on Akiva, throwing him into a war.
I'm basically the worst mother ever, she thinks. But they're both alive,
and she decides to forgive herself then for all the things that happened. Justice and revenge are two warring forces, but for her, she rejects them both. No need anymore to get revenge on herself for what she did, or seek justice and recompense for the kind of mother she's been. Forgiveness for herself comes blooming inside her, bright as a star and warm as the noonday sun. Maybe it's the drink. Maybe it's a night out with friends. But it feels like a great deal of ugliness in her is suddenly washing out to sea. Gone away. Goodbye.
Love you, kiddo,
she says to her son.
Love you, Mom.
It's past your bedtime, Snap.
He snaps his fingers to demonstrate.
Or we could just stay up all night and watch the boats go out to catch fish in the morning.
Just this once. Then we gotta pack. The Corellian Academy calls.
They stand and they go. Not sure whether their adventures have ended or have only just begun.
Epilogue. The Unknown Regions.
Traveling the abyss beyond the known galaxy takes months. The months for Sloane are hard and lonely. The Imperialis is a cold, impeccably designed ship, and she shares it with a pack of wild children and the haggard, haunted remnant of the man named Brendel Hux. The early days of the trip were spent worrying about whether or not one day Hux would rally his vicious orphans to slay her while sleeping. But once she saw that the children listened to Hux's own son, a pale slip of a boy with a tassel of red hair, she went to him and asked young Armitage to make a deal with her. She said to Armitage, "If you're willing to keep me safe from the children, then I will keep you safe from your father. Do we have an accord?" The boy nodded and said that they did. And then she found Brendel Hux in his room, and she showed him a swatch of Rax's bloody cape and the data spike containing the map coordinates. She said that she knew Brendel always hated her, and that the feeling was mutual. But if they are to carry forth the banner of the Empire, then they are to be allies, however reluctant. The oaf made a mistake then. He came at her. His hands reached for her throat. Even beaten and bruised as she was, it took her no time to hyperextend his knee with a hard kick. As he doubled over, mewling, she grabbed a hank of his messy hair, and she began to beat him. She hit him, punching and kicking the man until he was on the floor, on his knees, whimpering. Sloane told him, "If you ever cross me, I will visit this same violence upon you 100-fold. Whatever waits for us out here, you're with me. You will not betray me. You will not question me. Do you understand?" He nodded, smiling through tears, blubbering that he was her man. Then she added, "Your son, Armitage. I know you don't like him. I suspect you hurt him. Psychologically or physically, I don't know, and I don't care. You will leave him alone, and you will teach the boy everything that you know. Are we clear?" More blubbering, more nodding. That solved that problem. It did not, however, solve the problem of her loneliness. For the duration of the trip, she remained away from the children, away from Hux. She kept to herself, occupying her time looking at the ship's records, studying its history, its flight time, its communications, its weapons. The ship, like all of Palpatine's yachts, bears the maker mark of Wraith Sinar. It is perhaps unsurprisingly well fitted with hidden ordnance. Most yachts, after all, are not loaded for bear with Umbaran electromagnetic plasma cannons. Also unsurprising is that this ship, given that it's a replica, has had very little flight time. It went from the shipyard over Castel to Jakku, and has remained there for years, going all the way back to when Sinar was a Republic corporation. What is surprising is that not long after takeoff, the ship transmitted a very small packet of data to a dozen different sources. Ship transmitters, by the look of it. And it takes digging to unlock even this much. Sloane had no one to ask but the strange droid piloting the ship. And so she asked the Sentinel, "What did we transmit? And to whom?" The Sentinel answered,
"Path coordinates. Sent to Imperials considered loyal."
"Who considered them loyal? Rax?"
"Emperor Palpatine."
"Are you loyal to Palpatine?"
"All sentinels and messengers are programmed to serve his will, even in death."
"Good," she said,
though she was not then and is not now sure how good it really is. What waits for them now remains a mystery. Who waits, and who will follow in their wake, is an even more troubling conundrum. And all that assumed they even make it. The journey through the unknown regions has been harrowing. Taking short hyperspace jumps through the chaos has been like navigating a dangerous maze at full speed. But the Sentinel assured her the path was safe. They skirted superstorms and saw strange creatures out there in the blackness of the void. They lost system power when a magnetic burst of mysterious origin cascaded through space. But it was only for a few hours, and with power restored, they were able to continue on. It doesn't help that all along, her side has ached fiercely. Every morning she checked the old injury, and though the bruise has faded, The ribs look soft and caved in, and even the faintest fluttering touch of her fingertips upon the skin causes her great pain. Something is broken inside. She tells herself she will fix it when they land on the eclipse. If they land on the eclipse. Truth is, Sloane almost didn't come on this journey. When she finally shut down the self-destruct mechanism on the observatory, the one that would have split the world of Jakku in twain, wiping out both the Empire and the New Republic forces, she thought about remaining there on that world. Then she toyed with the idea of following Nora and looking for her own way to the New Republic. Maybe they would imprison her. Maybe they would give her a job. Maybe someone would quietly slit her throat and dump her in the sea. No matter the outcome, at least she would find some purpose, however short. But then the old ambition came alive once more. A campfire she thought was dark, suddenly glowing once more with a kindled ember. If there's a chance to rebuild the Empire, shouldn't I take it? Couldn't she make it better? In her own image? She felt the promise of a frontier nation born of loyalty and order, and not given over to the backstabbing and incest of the Empire that Palpatine created and Gallius Rax destroyed. They are pioneers in this space. They are the first outside the charted limits of the galaxy. She realized, it can be mine, if only I am willing to take it. Soon, they will be at their destination. And soon, it will be hers to take. The Imperialis glides gleaming around the edges of a geomagnetic storm. At a distance, it looks like threads of hazy light, diaphanous and spectral, emerging from a blue-black cloud and finding one another in the void, the light braiding and twisting.
There,
Brendel Hux says. Hux has cleaned himself up. His hair and beard are trimmed. He's lost some of the paunch he brought with him. Sloane sees what he indicates. In the distance, the lean blade of a super star destroyer dreadnought floats beyond the light and in the black. She knows that ship. The Eclipse. To the sentinel droid piloting the Imperialis, she says,
Take us in. It's time to rejoin with those who came before.
She does not fully know who was sent ahead. Hux did not know himself. Is it the original crew of the Eclipse? Were the others hand-selected by Palpatine or by Rax? She cannot say, and she is eager to solve that riddle, and worried about the answer. If those present are loyal to the others, but refuse loyalty to her, then her stewardship of this new empire will be woefully short. She knows that no matter what, her struggle has not ended. It has only begun. And this worries her considerably. Her worries are myriad. Will Hux betray her when they join with the others? Who comes after? Do they serve him or her? Can she be the legacy of Palpatine? Or must she always contend with the ghost of Gallius Rax, his presence lingering in those who remain? That man's influence was a virus, infectious and potentially incurable. Then there comes a question of the children, those bright-eyed monsters. They train every day here on board the ship at the urging of both Brendel and his son Armitage. Armitage has grown more vicious during these months, even for such a small boy. Sloane likes him, but she worries about him too. They could colonize it all. Their new galaxy will never have known a time without an empire. That thrills her. And indeed, it worries her too.
It's time to start over, she says to Hux. That is our first order. To begin again. And to get it right this time.
Yes, of course, Grand Admiral. Anything you need. Glory be to Grand Admiral Sloane.
No, she says. Glory goes only to the Empire. My Empire, she thinks.
This is Mark Thompson. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Star Wars Aftermath, Empire's End, Book 3 of the Aftermath Trilogy, by Chuck Wendig. This program was directed by Kevin Thompson, executive producer Aaron Blank. Star Wars Aftermath, Empire's End is a production of Lucasfilm Limited and registered or trademarked where indicated. Copyright 2017. All rights reserved. Used under authorization. Music composed by John Williams. Music publishing by Warner Tamerlane Publishing Corporation and Bantha Music. Music master production copyright 2007, Lucasfilm Limited. This has been a Penguin Random House audio presentation. All rights reserved.